1600s England was a time of tremendous turmoil. Plague wiped out one-fifth of London's population and shook the whole of Europe. Fires and disease were widespread, and fear of God defined most citizens' relationship to religion. It's the subject of Edward Dolnick's latest book. He's the former chief science writer at the Boston Globe and has written on a wide range of topics, from Freud to art theft to John Wesley Powell's exploration of the Grand Canyon. And he joins me now to talk about The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, The Royal Society, and The Birth of the Modern World, which is published by HarperCollins. Welcome to our show.
Well, thanks very much.
This book is really as much a set of biographies as it is about science. Did it begin with an interest in Newton and then just grow?
Well, this was a terrific era. Newton is the star figure of the day and one of the strangest people who ever lived. So it's easy when you start learning about him to get more and more wrapped up in his tale.
Well, were you surprised by how many of these characters turned out to be quite eccentric?
That was a lot of the fun of the story. When we talk about the great names of the past in science, Newton, Galileo, Kepler, there's a tendency to talk about them as if they were time travelers, as if they were men of the modern age who happened to live a long time ago and wear funny wigs. But in fact, they were not like us. And learning about that was one of the treats of writing the book.
They're very much of their times. And that's why so many people are confused about Newton's interest in alchemy, which we'll get to later. But who were some of the other interesting people in this group? Were they friends?
No. It so happened that although they had a great deal to do with one another, these early scientists were a rambunctious, cantankerous, contentious set. They had a lot of trouble bearing to be in the same room as one another. Newton had a great rival, Robert Hooke, who was one of the first to use the microscope. Hooke, a bad-tempered, competitive fellow. He had, in a sense, Salieri to Newton's Mozart, although not quite, had the bad fortune to be interested in just the same kind of things that Newton came along and did much better. There was Robert Boyle, who was an aristocrat, one of the richest men in England, one of the few sweet-tempered men in this set. Christopher Wren, the architect, as we know him, but in fact, in his day, known first as a scientist and an astronomer, and the architecture was something that he did almost on the side.
So we're talking about a remarkable group of men. History seems to have these sorts of outcroppings at different times. Einstein isn't alone in doing another, leading another period of scientific and mathematical exploration. Suddenly, a whole bunch of people come along and they're all doing something exciting.
You get these clusters akin to the founding fathers almost, and no one has come up with a good theory. After the fact, you can say, well, it all made sense, the intellectual ferment and so on.
Or zeitgeist. Suddenly, all these ideas are coming to a head and smart people are all thinking about them.
There are certain eras where astonishing things happen very, very quickly. And the 1660s was one of them. The surprise was that it was a time when it looked as if the world was falling apart. As you said, there's plague, there's fire. And it's that moment when people look, when scientists look out and say, if you look at it in the right way, it all makes perfect sense. It's all a perfect machine.
Now, how do they come to form the Royal Society if they didn't get along with each other?
Well, it made for rambunctious, cantankerous meetings. There were big problems about who would speak and whose turn it was, and if you would boycott the meeting of one of your rivals. It was an informal group, more akin to a book group, say, than a formal society early on.
How much of this involves your own personal story? You write, a deep dive into mathematics has special appeal, for it serves at the time as a way to flee the world and to impose order on it. And we're talking about a world at this time that needs a little order imposed on it. Is mathematics still practiced in isolation today?
Yes, it's a very peculiar field. I was at one point in my life an aspiring mathematician. I was only good enough to catch on that I wasn't quite good enough. But it's practiced by a peculiar set of people, a kind of they're like chess savants or musical prodigies. They have a talent. It's very hard to communicate to the rest of the world. They feel that they're onto something terribly deep, even though a lot of people aren't much interested in what they're up to.
Well, since math and physics go hand in hand, was that true for the physicists as well, the other scientists of the time?
Early on, the mathematicians and the physicists were essentially the same people because everything was so new that to invent a new theory in one field was almost inevitably to step into another.
And these people also called themselves natural philosophers. So did they see themselves as philosophers?
Yes. What they were doing, they felt convinced, was decoding the universe. God had set up the universe. He had arranged every twig, every feature in everyone's life, every recovery from disease or every succumbing to it was part of God's plan. And it was the task of these natural philosophers to sort out that plan, to see the hidden message beneath it.
And so we have philosophy, mathematics, and science, and all the other sciences all mixed together at this point. Later on, they all become specialties.
The specialization is much later. As late as 1900, people would say about one brilliant person or another, Poincaré, the French scientist, that he was the last person who knew everything.
Now, what follows this in England is the Enlightenment. Is there a connection between this and the Enlightenment, which of course then inspired the American founding fathers?
There's a close connection. What happens with these scientists is they say, look beneath the chaos and you'll find a deeper order. There are laws that govern the way the natural world works. That was so successful that people said there may be laws, although we haven't found them yet, for the way the political world ought to work, the way the economic world ought to work. There is an answer out there.
Well, today many scientists do not believe in God. A few do, but we've seen this major separation. And you say these people were all strong believers. They were all devout. Didn't that lead them sometimes into conflicting situations?
Well, it led them into a terrible predicament because what they thought they were doing in explaining how nature worked was paying homage to God. But they did such a good job at finding these laws of nature and at showing that nature was mathematical that they crowded God out of the picture. There wasn't room for a God to reach in with burning bushes and raising the dead anymore, it seemed, in a clockwork universe.
So when they were attacked by theologians for some of their ideas, how did they answer?
What they tried to say was, it's not that we're undercutting the arguments in favor of God. What we're doing is demonstrating the beauty and the craftsmanship and the universal application of his work. Everywhere you look, you see God's hand, they say.
Well, perhaps they were talking about a different idea of God than the other people had. The other people had the God of the Bible, and they had the God of the creator and nature.
Yes, one of the lines that the early scientists took, and they took it sincerely, I think, was that the miracles and so on of the Bible were necessary on God's part because the common people wouldn't understand if he had simply handed down equations instead of laws in the Ten Commandments. But what he was really doing was a subtle and scientific kind of creation.
Was writing about math I'm curious about Newton. Was he a believer in God? How devout was he?
Newton was ferociously devout. His belief in God was one of his most sincere beliefs. But as you say, the moral that later scientists drew from his success was that they didn't need God. Newton would have been furious and miserable to know the lesson that other people would draw from his career.
You refer to many of the Royal Society's experiments, especially those in medicine, as outlandish. Can you give us some examples?
Well, this is a good example of just how these men were different from us. They weren't modern men. Robert Boyle, who was probably the most eminent scientist in the generation just before Newton, believed that a cure for cataract was a ground-up human excrement made into powder blown into the patient's eyes. He had all sorts of medical potions based on ground unicorn horn, that kind of thing.
And they had blood transfusions from sheep to humans, obviously not understanding that that would be a really dangerous thing to do. But they were also willing to experiment on humans, which is something we wait a while to do today.
The men of the Royal Society, although they're great eminent names to us, like Christopher Wren, were like the most rambunctious teenagers with a chemistry set you can imagine. They were constantly taking blood from one thing to another, pumping the air out of a chamber and putting a critter in it or a human to see what would happen. Would he survive?
They removed spleens of animals to see if it was possible to disprove the four humors theory. Then they had these alchemic ointments that were made from skulls of unburied men. That was important, that they were unburied?
This was one of the ingredients. Yes, you had to get the recipe just so. In the same way as if the oven is 400 degrees instead of 350, it will make a difference to your souffle.
Newton worked in pretty much in isolation, didn't he?
Yes, Newton.
Would he have been – if he had tried to work in as a member of a team, as scientists do today, with the other scientists of his day, could that have worked?
No. Newton was undeniably brilliant, but a profoundly antisocial man. He could bear adulation, but no, not a whiff of criticism. And so his notion was that he would work on his own. He would emerge with an answer. You could fall down in reverence at that answer, but you weren't allowed to say maybe I have a suggestion here or there.
And he didn't stay. He didn't do his work in London. He did it on his mother's farm.
He had been a student, an undergraduate at Cambridge when plague shut down the university. Everyone was booted out so the disease didn't spread. And in isolation, this teenager that no one had ever heard of laid the foundation for the modern world.
My guest is Edward Dolnick, whose latest book is The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, the Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. It's published by Harper. But I mentioned earlier that not only did Newton come up with some of the most important theories of the time that actually remain in place, at least as working models to this day, despite Einstein, but he also was fascinated by alchemy. Was that the cutting edge of chemistry at the time?
Yes, alchemy. We look on alchemy, which is where these experiments about the powdered skulls and all this come from, as a crackpot side issue to his real work. But for Newton, the alchemy was at least as important as the work on gravity and on light. Yes, it was new, it was modern, and he had high hopes for it.
Wasn't there also a religious component to that work?
Yes, alchemy had to do with the secrets of living matter. The gravity and the light had to do with what happens when you shoot cannonballs or drop rocks. But this was about how biology worked. How did life work?
Did Newton's discovery of gravity really begin with the proverbial apple falling?
Well, he told it that way. And most people take it to be not only that an apple fell, but that it bonked him on the head. He told the story in his old age. He was perfectly willing to embellish his legend. It doesn't seem likely. Everyone, it didn't take Newton to know that that apples fall and that rocks fall. What it took Newton to say was to pay attention to that, to say, why does that matter? What does it tell us? That took Newton's genius.
But it was easy to observe that kind of thing. But then he comes up with the theory that the moon is falling little by little rather than remaining stationary in the sky. That's not as easily observed.
No. In fact, not only isn't it easy to observe, it seems manifestly wrong. The moon's not falling anywhere. It just sits there. And so Newton explained the sense in which it is falling, and he explained the sense in which an apple falls. And then he showed not only are they both falling, but the same law governs the fall of each, whether something is near or something is as far away as the moon or as far away as you can imagine. One law applies to everything.
And how was he able to prove that?
Well, it requires some math that first he had to invent. That was calculus. So he first asks the question, then he invents the tools to answer it, then he provides the answers. And the world was so bowled over by this that Newton was treated almost with godlike reverence.
Oh, so people receive this without questioning, or Weren't there religious people who just felt the whole thing was heresy?
Religious people said that Newton had missed the point of what he had found, but they didn't deny that he had found it. Newton was a scientific celebrity. He was the Einstein of his day. People didn't understand it necessarily, but they knew this is the man.
But he developed calculus, as you say. But simultaneously, so did Gottfried Leibniz, not to prove gravity. What was Leibniz doing?
So he's another universal genius, a great rival of Newton's. Newton had invented calculus as a young man and hadn't told anyone, which was characteristic of him. Leibniz comes along and, for reasons to do strictly with challenges in math, comes up with the same theory, but he tells the world. And now Newton is furious. What's Leibniz doing claiming credit for my work, even though no one knew it was his work? And for the rest of his life, for decades afterwards, Newton and Leibniz feud with one another, each accusing the other of stealing his great idea.
You describe science at this time as coming into its own as a contact sport and a dueling ground. Everybody wanted credit. This is before you could win a Nobel Prize.
These were big stakes. That people understood that these questions had been asked for a long time. The one who got credit for coming up with the answer was going to be quite a hero, and no one wanted to give up that glory.
Both Newton and Leibniz saw calculus as a tribute to God, didn't they?
What calculus did for them, for most of us, it's just the name of a scary subject. What it did for Newton and Leibniz was give them a way to talk about things that were moving, whether they were rocks falling from the Tower of Pisa or planets around the sun. And yes, this gave them a God's eye view of the universe.
But they disagreed on almost everything. Newton believed that the ancients knew most, if not all, of what he was trying to prove. Leibniz saw himself as a real pioneer. And Leibniz disagreed over gravity.
They hated one another and fought for decades. Leibniz thought that when Newton came up with this theory of gravity, all he had done was give a fancy name to a puzzle that we still didn't understand. If he asked, why do rocks fall? Newton said, well, I don't know why, but I can tell you how long they'll take to hit the ground. Leibniz said, that's not enough. That's not an explanation. What's really going on?
But they each accused the other of heresy and defacement of Christianity. That goes beyond, well, I think his theory isn't really working well.
Their feud started narrowly to do with priority in mathematics. Then it spilled over into science. And as everything did in those days, it ended up as a fight over God. Which of them, Newton or Leibniz, had the proper picture of God in his kingdom?
So in an odd way, this is a cusp time, a time where we are carrying over the old ideas and into the new ideas. But your subtitle here is The Birth of the Modern World. So how does this lead to the modern world?
The modern world in science takes for granted this notion that there are laws of nature, that it doesn't matter if we shoot a rocket at the moon or if the Chinese shoot a rocket, so long as they aim it according to Newton's laws, they'll get the same results. This notion of universal laws that transcend cultural or geographic differences is one of the things that made technology and science for the 1800s and 1900s, and it's based on these discoveries.
We don't have a royal society today. Would it be a good idea?
Well, yes. As science has grown so specialized that it's terribly hard for people to know what's going on in another field. Meetings where they do try to bring in neighbors to talk over their work turn out quite often to be useful, just because it's hard for a Newton today to have all of science in his head.
Of course, there was so much to figure out in those days, and they had so many problems. There was a lot more that one scientist, any genius, could do. Today, you're kind of limited, aren't you, trying to prove string theory, for example?
Well, it's certainly true that nearly any question you could ask in the 1600s was a new and bewildering question. It is true that to get to the frontier today takes vastly more time. Newton was asking and answering questions that no one had ever done before when he was 20 years old. Not many 20-year-olds, even Stephen Hawking types, can do that today.
Although most of these people were rather young. Edward Dolnick is the author of The Forger's Spell, Down the Great Unknown, The Rescue Artist, Madness on the Couch. Most recent, the book we've been discussing, The Clockwork Universe, Isaac Newton, The Royal Society, and the Birth of the Modern World. It's published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.